The Guardian. Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
We open this podcast with the sad news that Dame Beryl Bainbridge has died at the age of 75. She was, of course, a wonderful writer and one of the great characters of the literary world. Here she is, talking at a Guardian book club last year about her novel on the Titanic disaster, Every Man for Himself.
When I was at school, at the end of the war, all children from the age of 7 right up to the 6th form, we were marched to the Philharmonic Hall in Liverpool, and we were shown the troops going into Belsen or Buchenwald, one of the concentration camps. And to see, nothing was explained. We weren't told why this had happened. We knew when it had happened. And it had an incredible effect on me. I suppose it turned my mind in a way, so that life wasn't what it was supposed to be. Life is always full of horrors and mysteries and reasons why people behave like that. So that was the reason for doing about disasters. But the other reason why, going into history, why I was suddenly interested in history was something quite different. It was the fact that I'd worked for a publisher for years, writing about, you say, part fiction, partly made up. But I don't think I ever made anything up. I only used characters I knew, mostly, say, my mother and my father, my brother, my aunts, myself. And I'd put a plot in the middle. But I wasn't interested in making anything up. I was just wanting to tell the story of my life, you know, the story of that all-around one. I mean, I had a childhood, a slightly puzzling childhood, in that my father had been a very rich man. Not very rich, but he'd been very well off in business. He'd sold diamonds in Holland and all sorts of things. And then the slump of 1929 came, and my mother, they'd just got married, and my mother had married him on the rebound, thinking she was going into a life of luxury. And suddenly he was a bankrupt. So that when my brother and I were born, life was entirely different. You know, we moved from this huge house in a place called the Wirral, which is a posh part of Liverpool, and we moved to a place called Formby, which is down the railway line between Liverpool and Southport. And so that's all I was interested in writing about, nothing else at all. But by the time I had to change the sort of things I was writing about, I'd used up all the things about my childhood and my parents. I hadn't anything else left to write about, frankly. You know, it had all been done. And anyway, this was about 12 or 13 books later, so I was older, and different things were more interesting. So that's why I went into the history.
Beryl Bainbridge, who died on Friday. The publisher Beryl worked for all those years was Colin Haycraft of Duckworth. He never paid her more than £2,000 for a book and only ever printed 3,000 copies. One theory about her blossoming into historical fiction was that his death in 1994 liberated her. Haycraft was one of the great mavericks of independent publishing. Surely they wouldn't be a place for him today in this age of multinational corporations churning out bestsellers by the ton. Or would there?
Sometimes the most exciting writing is not the writing that sells most at all. And you need editors and you need publishers who champion that work. And I think independent publishers and I think independent bookshops are where you find that passion.
That was the Australian novelist Christos Tsolkas. We'll hear more from him later. If you don't believe him, have a listen to this.
As Bunny turns into Church Road, the DJ is still talking about Kylie's gold lamé hot pants, how they are housed in a temperature-controlled vault in a museum in Australia and have reportedly been insured for $8 million, more than the Turin Shroud. Out of the radio comes a song that Bunny cannot identify, and suddenly the whole thing is lost in a blast of static, and Bunny Rabbit punches the radio and says, "Fuck," whereupon heavy classical music blasts out. The music sounds like it is trumpeting the advent of something way beyond the bounds of terrible. Bunny looks askance at the car radio. He feels spooked by it, the way it seems to choose at random what it wants to hear. And he turns the volume down. "Fucking radio," says Bunny.
The inimitable Nick Cave performing his novel The Death of Bunny Munro on audiobook, just one of the unusual products to have come out of the Independent Alliance of Publishers in the last year. The Alliance is 5 years old this month, and with me to celebrate its anniversary is Stephen Page, publisher and boss at Faber & Faber, and one of the prime movers, and the critic and broadcaster Alex Clark. Stephen, there are 10 publishers in this alliance. Can you explain exactly what it is and what it does?
Yeah, so it has at its heart an arrangement where Faber offers to sell the books for those publishers to parts of the book market. But that early idea really grew very quickly into it becoming a kind of community.
Mm-hmm. Alex, as far as the reader's concerned, it's the books that count. And in fact, I don't think Stephen at this stage knows this, that the winner of this year's Samuel Johnson Prize is Granter, and the book is Nothing to Envy, Real Lives in North Korea by Barbara Demick. So is that significant that it's from an independent?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because on the shortlist of the Samuel Johnson, the Independent Alliance was hugely represented. So this book was published by Granter, this winning book. But Faber was also represented on the shortlist, and Atlantic and Profile, who are also members. And there were only one or two, I think, mainstream, you know, conglomerate publishers, and they fell by the wayside rather from the long list. And of course, this could be sort of pure coincidence, but it's interesting nonetheless. So you certainly see small publishers really punching above their weight.
And this book is not an obvious title, is it? It's not the sort of thing that you imagine is going to grab the front window of Waterstones, is it? It's about testimony from North Korea.
Exactly. It's about, I think the writer followed six people from a small port town in eastern North Korea who had subsequently defected, and she gathered together and pieced together their lives and gives us a kind of portrait of what's inside North Korea. Mm-hmm.
Stephen, that's perhaps not going to shift millions of copies, but you have had some incredible bestsellers in the 5 years, haven't you?
And they're interesting bestsellers. You know, they're not genre bestsellers. They're not crime novelists who, after five books, have suddenly hit the jackpot because of a TV series or something. So there are some interesting, for instance, Eat Shoots and Leaves was possibly one of the earliest big hits in the Alliance's history, published by Profile, Lynn Truss's book about punctuation. And there are lots more of those. I mean, for instance, Does Anything Eat Wasps, which was another Profile book.
That was from New Scientist.
That was a New Scientist, apparently columns, but no, it was made into a terrifically interesting book. If you look at the fiction that's been taken on in the Alliance, DBC Pierre's Vernon Godlittle, published by Faber, The White Tiger, published by Atlantic, you know, both Booker Prize winners. 700,000 copies, and eventually the translated novels of Stieg Larsson, you know, which have now sold over 4 million copies in the edition published by Quercus.
So what about genre? That strikes me that that's looking through your list. That's another thing that some of your members do very well. Serpent's
like
Tale.
Serpent's Tale, who just really have always specialised in that kind of noir fiction, haven't they?
Yes, there is a growing amount of kind of genre publishing within the Alliance as the Alliance gets more confident. I mean, one of the interesting questions about a publisher like Harville in the late 90s, when Harville did get bought by Random House, turn of the century, one of the things the Alliance does that couldn't have been done before was to combine the publishing of these publishers and take them to the full range of the market. Mm-hmm. So Tesco's are very keen to see the salesperson from the Alliance. But for the reason for that, they're as keen as an independent bookshop. We don't show Tesco's obviously very many books, but individually we'd never get to see. So when a book breaks and becomes successful, we're able to get it across the whole market, across the whole planet. And that's because of the strength of the selling arrangement. But more to the point, that allows for a sort of hopeful exchange and an opportunity for books, which means that the editorial conversation can always be one where people aren't saying, what we need is something we know we can sell.
Mm. Do you shape your lists around each other? So would you say, oh, Profile's very good at doing those sort of Christmas novelty books, so we won't do that?
Not really. I think we learn from each other. And one of the joys of the Alliance is that each publishing house is so distinct, so unusually itself. And that's a lot, again, to do with the shape of the the human beings in the companies, the character of them, their taste.
Alex, another feature that struck me was loyalty to particular writers. And we're in an age now when it's very difficult for a writer, to, particularly a mid-list writer, to sustain a career.
Yes, and when people have had a kind of early success or even a sort of growing success and then fail to sustain it over later books, you just see them being offered increasingly less attractive deals by their mainstream publishers that mean that it's very hard for them to write full-time. And I think a lot of people, like, for example, Chris Paling, who's a really talented novelist, who was published by Cape for a long time and then, I guess, couldn't get a deal, couldn't continue that relationship, and was published by Portobello.
And there's a long history of this. I mean, Frederick Warburg took on H.G. Wells at a point where no one would publish him, right at the end of his life. And Warburg was struggling to make his business a success, but he took on H.G. Wells, really, because he was so flattered that H.G. Wells would want to be published by him. And it was a huge success, and Warburg, you know, sort of phoenix from the ashes, and you know, both H.G. Wells' own writing and the publishing house thrived.
So there is a sort of romance about the small
guy, isn't there? In general, it's probably worth saying those writers, the quality of their writing hasn't changed, hasn't lessened. It's just that the environment has become kind of increasingly tough, and also you feel that editors in mainstream publishing houses are under extraordinary amounts of pressure to provide lists that are going to give a kind of guaranteed turnover.
Let's just talk a little bit about this issue of flair, which I'm very interested in. Richard, it just strikes me that you look through this list. Lynn Truss, you mentioned Lynn Truss, Eat, Shoots and Leaves. That's an amazingly original sort of book to publish. Lionel Shriver, published by Serpent's Tail, went on to win prizes. There's a sense of that there is a sort of sparkle in these lists, but flashes in the pan sometimes.
History of publishing is full of these moments of connection where extraordinary things happen for books that you really, as the publisher, you know, no publisher could have said that the book would create such a level of success. Sometimes when good things happen for a book, they're at quite a small scale. And then if you just move on to the next thing, you go to the bottom of the hill, whereas actually a much better thing to do is to keep pushing with the things that are finding some purchase, some way forward. And I think that's something that all of these publishers do incredibly well. They're relentless in their enthusiasms.
So, for example, we could mention Sebastian Barry, who you've been publishing for a while.
Faber published him as a playwright. We published four novels now, and the fourth novel, Secret Scripture, gathered an audience 20 times larger than the one before that, which was shortlisted for the Booker.
Won the Costa.
And then Secret Scripture then won the Costa. And, you know, but Barry was a writer who'd excited everybody from the first page of his first play, let alone the first novel. You know, he's just a natural for the Faber list.
Secret Scripture sold 700,000 copies. If this were Random House, would they be pleased with that? Is that a really good...
I mean, my view is that there's no level. Different reach into the market. That's the thing the Alliance has achieved. There's no kind of, well, if only we'd published it in a big house, then they'd have had more muscle and we'd have sold more. That might be true for a celebrity memoir or a big piece of genre crime, but it's not true for books that just work and find readership. You know, there's no place we can't get a book to, you know, that a big publishing house can. We just have an enormous cultural range, you know, to sell as well.
But there is another element to this, isn't there, which is nimbleness. And, I mean, there are novelties among the things that have been published.
Oh, yes.
Including, you know, your own Faber Finds, which is audience reactive, isn't it? Or readership reactive.
Yes, I think, you know, innovation is always sort of rather jokingly at the top of every flip chart of every company on the planet, and they think they're the first to think of it, you know. But innovation is critical in publishing. Being able always to see that the thing that's just worked isn't the thing that you're now looking for. You're looking for something new. And nimbleness, I think, is a lot about being quick to move on from the status quo, because the market will always say, I want today what sold yesterday. I want that. That's what I want, surely. Of course, what you know is that that's now already a decreasing opportunity. So I think, you know, Faber Finds is an interesting example where we were kind of frustrated by all of this talk of long tail, you know, the idea that there was the internet allowed everything to be available all the time and everything was fine again. And we knew that wasn't really true, because you had to publish, you have to make something happen if you're going to create an audience for a book that's been forgotten. So we made a print-on-demand only list and started to draw together lots of book enthusiasts who then recommended books to us. And, of course, the first community we went to do this was the writers.
And so, how successful has it been?
very successful in its own terms.
So what does that mean, in its own terms?
It means that we're selling tens of thousands of books. We've got 700 books in print that would otherwise be out of print, and another 300-400 waiting to come back into print. They're all really good books, and they sell between 10 copies and 1,000 copies. And we make a little bit of money out of it. But to be honest, the success is much more in the endeavour.
The blog to book hasn't really worked, has it? And the Friday Project had a lot of problems with blogs to books, didn't it?
But, you know, failure is merely experimentation that doesn't come off. You know, it's not really... I think it's quite harsh to say... If no one had tried blog to book, we'd have all said, God, publishing's so slow, it doesn't take any notice of what people are writing. You know, that kind of mantra I hear a lot. Whereas I actually don't think it's a terrifically good idea to take a medium like the blog and say that it naturally transfers into another medium, which is the book.
Unless it's Belle de Jour and involves sex.
There's a clue for us all.
Well, one of the unexpected hits of the summer is an Australian novel which has been brought to the UK by a new imprint, Tusker Rock, set up by the writer Colm Toybean and the agent Peter Strauss under the umbrella of the Alliance publisher Atlantic. The Slap has been described as that rare quadrilla in publishing, a page-turner that sells lots of copies, gets great reviews and wins literary awards. It's the fourth novel by Christos Tsolkas, who dropped in earlier this week to talk to us. He began by reading from the opening scene, a suburban barbecue in Melbourne, at which four-year-old Hugo is behaving badly.
No. No, 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 no. It was as if the child had become lost in the very word, as if all the word was contained in the screaming of this one negative syllable. No, 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 no. It was Hugo. All of them now, Hector figured, must know that it could only be Hugo. It was the men who rushed outside, as if the child's screams were somehow connected to the rules of the game, and therefore it was the men who should arbitrate in that dispute. Hugo was awkwardly slamming the bat on the ground. He needed to hold onto it with both hands, but his grip was strong. He would not let it go. Ravi was trying to plead with the little boy. Rocco was frowning behind the wicket. It's all right, Hugo. You're not out. He is! Rocco was standing his ground. He got LBW'd. Ravi smiled at the older boy. Listen, he doesn't even know what that means. Gary jumped off the veranda and began to walk towards his son. Come on, Hugo. I'll explain why you're out.
No!
The same piercing scream. The boy looked as if he was going to hit his father with a bat. Put the bat down now. The boy did not move. Now! There was silence. Hector realised he was holding his breath.
You're out, Hugo, you bloody spoil sport!
Rocco, at the end of his tether, went to grab the bat from the younger boy. With another scream, Hugo evaded the older boy's hands, and then, leaning back, he lifted the bat. Hector froze. He's going to hit him. He's going to belt Rocco with that bat. In the second that it took Hector to release his breath, he saw Ravi jump towards the boys, he heard Gary's furious curse, and he saw Harry push past all of them and grab at Hugo. He lifted the boy up in the air, and in shock, the boy dropped the bat.
Let me go, Hugo roared.
Harry set him on the ground. The boy's face had gone dark with fury. He raised his foot and kicked wildly into Harry's shin. The speed was coursing through Hector's blood. The hairs on his neck were upright. He saw his cousin's raised arm. It spliced the air, and then he saw the open palm descend and strike the boy. The slap seemed to echo. It cracked the twilight. The little boy looked up at the man in shock. There was a long silence. It was as if he could not comprehend what had just occurred, how the man's action and the pain he was beginning to feel coincided. The silence broke, the boy's face crumpled, and this time there was no wail. When the tears began to fall, they fell silently.
Well, obviously that silence isn't going to last very long. I asked Christos what inspired him to think of putting such a very dramatic event right at the beginning of the novel.
It actually came from a moment my parents were having a barbecue where a similar incident happened, but with none of the kind of gravity or the trauma. What happened, Mum was cooking in the kitchen. She's a fantastic cook, my mum, and I don't just mean that as a nice Greek boy. She was, there were friends, there were family.
She was cooking this enormous meal, and this little boy, Jack, who's a three-year-old son of a friend of mine, was playing in the kitchen and kind of upsetting things. And she kept telling him, please, Jack, please, stop, stop. And he wouldn't listen to her. And at one point, with the gentlest intent, really, she just lifted him by the shoulder and gave him a little pat on the buttocks. Like, just there was nothing aggressive in what she did. But Jack kind of put his hands on his hip. I'll never forget this, his hands on his hips, and just and went to my mum, no one is allowed to touch my body without my permission. And my mum looked at him in equal astonishment and went, if you're naughty, I hit you. You know, and that, we all laughed, and that incident kept going through my mind, and I thought, I've been wanting to write about contemporary Australia because I feel like that there is certain stories and silences around what contemporary Australia is at the moment, and this is a perfect way to begin because the difference between my mother's experience of life and culture and questions of adulthood and questions of childhood are so very different to this little boy.
Mm-hmm. So although Harry is the character who delivers the slap, it's actually observed from his cousin Hector's position. Now, Hector is the narrator of that first section, and this is your part of your technique as well, as you have each section narrated by a different character.
That's right. The novel itself, the finished novel, is it through eight voices. All of them are the voices of people who were there at the barbecue where the slap happened, but it's not the Rashomon effect. It's not that we see the slap eight different times. The narrative builds chronologically through the chapters. And that for me was actually just, that was the pleasure of writing this book, was to see if I could pull that off.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at these different voices, because obviously you're saying something about the composition of Australian society, aren't you, with your choice of narrators? Hector, the first one, is a middle-aged, no better than he ought to be. None of your characters are better than they ought to be, really,
no.
Are they?
I think that comes out of, I'm not interested in black and white characters. I'm not interested in, I don't think the world operates in absolutes anymore. And I think for me the most challenging writing is the one that makes me confront my own weaknesses and my and frailties as a human being. So a lot of people have said that they dislike the characters. I don't feel that dislike at all. I think they're human, all too human. But Hector is probably, I begin with Hector because he's probably the closest to me. He's closest to me that he too is a son of immigrant parents. He's my age. He is someone from a working class background who has made good, as we would say in Australia, and you'd probably say here. And so it made perfect sense that he would be the opening voice.
And his wife, Aisha, is Indian.
He's Indian, that's
and
right.
And his parents don't accept her, or at least certainly his mother can't accept her at all, she calls her the Indian.
Yeah, she won't call her by her name at all. She'll always go Indiana, which is Greek for the Indian woman. I think that was one of the things that I wanted to explore too, that there is something I absolutely adore about the culture I grew up in, the multiculturalism of a city like Melbourne, and particularly the spaces I inhabited and still inhabit. But there are also tensions there, and they're never as simplistic as what you get in a lot of media representations, and I wanted to give some kind of observance to that. It was really interesting when the book got nominated for the Commonwealth Prize, and after the award I spoke to one of the judges who was a Zimbabwean but living in South Africa, and she said that she had laughed when she had read that part of the book because one of her cousins had married a Greek man, and her grandmother still refused to call him by his first name. She would only call him the Greek. And it's just, I think those tensions say something interesting about Australia, but I do think that it's not only an Australian concern.
Now, I wondered the extent to which you were conscious of attempting to formulate a great Australian novel, because in some ways you can see echoes of the great American novel in this.
There wasn't a consciousness of wanting... there was a consciousness that I actually wanted to write a contemporary novel about Australia, and feeling that there are actually good reasons why it hasn't. You know, Australian authors have turned to the past to kind of deal with that colonial and racial legacy. I understand that completely, but it felt that there was this gap about what is contemporary Australia. How do we live our lives now? and that our fiction for too long had looked towards London, and I wanted to write against that. Yes, so in that way it was quite deliberate. And the other thing too is, you know, I've been influenced by that American literature. What the American literature gave me was a sense that I could write in English that was not an Anglo-English, that I actually can create a different kind of English. And I think that that's been quite an inspiring thing from really young, from the Americans. I'm looking forward to a time when I can say something similar about Australian writing.
Christos Tsiolkos, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's it from us today on the Books Podcast. We'll be back next week with a variety of travellers' tales. Meanwhile, in Saturday's Guardian Review, the mathematician Marcus de Sautoy looks at the effect new technology will have on literature. In Observer's new review on Sunday, writers and critics recommend the best reads for the summer. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer was Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.